At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This week on Unforgotten.
So when you put all of that together, the contradictions about the package, that freaking wrench, the station wagon, the checkbook, you're left with this unsettling picture.
Two men, father and son, who couldn't keep their story straight. Tina, who consistently placed Stephen in that car with them. And a deputy who denies ever sharing details that the Bowmans claim to have heard.
Which leaves us asking, what exactly did the Bowmans know about Stephen's finances, his car, his checkbook, and how did they know it?
Hey everyone, this is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten,
where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
And now for Season 2, Episode 5, Stephen Pearson, Part 3.
We wanted to say a quick thank you to our friend Jason Ussery for stepping in to help pull this episode together. Not only does the guy juggle his life, a job, and multiple podcasts, but he also somehow has time to swoop in here and save us. So thank you, Jason with the good hair. We appreciate you so much.
Hey guys, we're back today with the series finale of Stephen Pearson's case. But before we get into that, there are a couple things that we wanted to talk about that are unrelated to Stephen's case.
Yeah.
We got a call from Fulmington Police Department investigator Clay Smith about a missing man named David Lynn Scales. David is 66 years old, 160 pounds, and roughly 5'8". Quay said that David's brother had contacted him and said that the last time that he talked to David was on July 2nd and that he overheard a male and a female voice in the background telling him something about, like, hey, it's time to go, whatever. They got off the phone and he hasn't heard from his brother since. To our knowledge, the last location that David was known to be living is in the Jefferson County area, somewhere around possibly Fairfield, Bessemer. We've had a couple of different addresses, but his brother had come across an address in Plumerton, which is how Clay ended up with it. So Clay had just asked if we could share some information about it to try to help him run down where David was last known to be living. So if anybody listening happens to know Mr. Scales or where he might have been living, please give Investigator Smith a call at 251-296-5811. Or you can send us a message on our Facebook page, our email. We even have our tip line set up, which is 251-501-2653. It would be greatly appreciated. We don't do a lot of research on cases that are not at least 2 years old, just because most of the time those cases are active investigations and we don't really want to get involved with very active investigations because we don't know what's going on with those. And I know we've had people message us about cases that have occurred within like the last year, year and a half. This was an exception that we made because it was actually an agency reaching out to us asking, hey, we need some help here.
Yeah, just a little extra boost to kind of get some publicity out there for him.
Yeah. Also, we just posted some new merch on the website.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
Oh, there's some cute t-shirts on there.
Yeah, and personally, I can't wait to get that cap.
I know. Well, you know, the leather patch one that Jason brought in today and surprised me with, that was a sample that he had ordered just to make sure that it was going to look right. I didn't even know that was coming. It looks great. Cool. So yeah. Now we got to figure out. I don't even know where it came from. So I'm going to have to get that from him. Mm-hmm. But I like our unstructured cap that we have on there.
Yeah, those are the kind I like to wear.
I do too. It's getting close to time for us to do our normal shirts, you know, that have all the names on it. But I did post some shirts that don't have names. They just have Alabama Cold Case Advocacy. But the cover photo of ours that has the desk and the lantern and all of kind of like nods and Easter eggs to all of the little sayings that we have.
Yep.
We've got a shirt for that and a couple of different styles for those kind of things. And then we've got tumblers and notepads, I think, notebooks. I don't even remember what all I added on there. That's kind of sad.
Tumblr now. Jeez.
Oh, no, they're super
cute.
My
husband does not like how many cups I have.
But they're so cute.
They are. And I travel a lot.
There's
so,
a color-changing coffee mug on there, too.
Oh, yay.
Woohoo. Yep.
So that's all I need. You can't say no. It's for us.
It is. So if you haven't got your ACCA merch, go check it out over on alcoldcase.com.
And it helps support very important work that we're doing, trying to get these families some extra help. You know our mission. So yeah, go buy something.
Yeah. It helps pay for billboards and
it does, yeah.
Our podcast hosting platform. And I actually thought it was funny. I was headed to Birmingham for the Crime Stoppers luncheon Wednesday night. And so I'd made a post on the page and said, all right, guys, like drop me your favorite podcast. I've got a really long ride. And in the comments, somebody said, not me, about to tell you to listen to your own podcast.
Yeah, I saw that. That like, was hilarious.
I think I heard that one.
But that's good to know that, you know, we're the favorite of some people. So
apparently a couple of days ago, WKRG posted something and said, what's your favorite podcast? It was like 2 days ago, but it just popped up in my newsfeed today. And the first comment I saw was my mom, Unforgotten. And I was like, yeah, that's a good suggestion if I say so myself.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah. I was like, oh, thanks, Mom.
She's awesome. Your mom's great.
I ended up listening to S-Town.
Oh, yeah. So did it make you subscribe?
Okay, so you can listen to the first two episodes for free, and then you have to subscribe to the New York Times.
Gotcha.
I was listening to it and literally cross into Bibb County, and it's like, to listen to the next episode, subscribe. And I'm like, is it because I literally rolled into Shit Town?
Yeah, I know.
But then I'm hooked anyway.
I know. It's great.
I end up subscribing. I'm not done with it yet. I'm not even sure how many episodes there are, but I think I'm on 4 or 5 now. And I was like, this is not how I saw this going.
Yeah.
And so my boss listens to True Crime Podcast too. Hi, John. He asked me last time, where's part two? So I know he's listening. I sent him a message and was like, oh, here's your another podcast to listen to, because I sent him Bone Valley a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
He said, oh, I've already listened to that one. It's great. And I'm like, I got to stop there. Have you listened to it yet?
Bummed out. No, I keep...
No, not Bone Valley.
The S-Town?
Yes, S-Town.
Yeah, I did. It's been a long time, though. So I
gosh.
Don't remember.
I'm trying to be careful in case there are people who haven't listened to it. That's not how I thought it was going to go. And so when he said he'd already listened to it, I'm like, wait a second. Did this really happen? Are they going to change their opinion on this? And he's like, no, it did. I just can't remember exactly how. And so now I can't, I got to finish it. I'm kind of sad about it.
I was trying to pull it up because I thought I had already in my thing. That's kind of too bad, because if I already had it in my downloads, then I wouldn't have to subscribe.
Oh, is that how it works?
Well, if I downloaded it, because I listened to it before you had to subscribe.
Oh, I gotcha.
But I think I actually didn't keep it in my feed during it.
Well, it's not how I expected it to go, but I'm like hooked in now, and I'm like, well, I need to know about this shady stuff going on. What happened to the man's gold?
Yeah.
Don't tell me. I don't want to know.
I'm not going
to
tell you.
I mean, I do want to know, but I don't want you to tell me.
I don't want to spoil it, no.
But go listen to Bone Valley, because they're about to come out with a third season.
Yeah, I really do. It's actually been on my list, and I had it like auto-downloading, but I kept not having time to listen to it, so I just took it off, and I figure when I'm ready, I'm just going to download and binge.
Oh my God, it's so good. So good.
Good to know.
I cried. And I never cry.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And then also I saw where Todd McComas and Jessica Knoll are getting ready to potentially come out. Well, I say potentially. They're working on a new project with Tenderfoot.
Oh, yeah.
Don't know what it is yet. I feel like I should text her and ask her. But
yeah, totally.
I love their stuff. So
yeah, I saw that the other day too.
Yeah. Also, the highlight of my week was meeting Senator Britt at the luncheon and the luncheon.
Yeah, that was great.
The luncheon was great. Always love visiting with the Crime Stoppers guys. They're fantastic. And be on the lookout because we might be starting a podcast with them. We actually talked about it Thursday. We just have to get some logistics things kind of worked out. They did great. The luncheon was great. We made some really good connections. Like, the networking is always nice because it helps us kind of build those relationships that we need in order to get the awareness for the cases and to get the resources out there. And so I'm really hopeful that the connection with Senator Britt will only strengthen because she is very pro-law enforcement and anti-crime. So I think that that would be a very good collaboration. And then we got some special things coming out soon that I think will be kind of surprising.
Yeah, just know there's some things down the road.
Yeah, good things happening, man.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
I know that we are way into our recording time and not even remotely on the episode.
So, back to our series finale. So, if you haven't listened to parts 1 and 2, we definitely encourage you to go back and listen just so that you're up to speed with today's episode. But here's a quick recap.
So if you've been following closely, you'll remember every known sighting of Stephen Pearson, really I think from the beginning of December to the 27th, describes him driving his red Chevy Blazer.
Right. Every sighting except one.
And that one comes from Tina Bowman, the daughter of James Bowman Jr. and sister to Little Bowman.
On January 11th, 2001, Tina came to speak with investigators about a separate incident involving a shooting near some friends of hers. But while she was there, the conversation turned. Tina told Sheriff Birch and Sergeant Batiste that she believed she had information about Stephen Pearson's disappearance.
She told them Stephen was someone she considered a friend, not just to her, but to her brother too. According to her, Stephen and James, Little Bowman, were best friends until recently when they had a falling out.
Tina told investigators she returned from a trip to Florida on December 25th, Christmas Day, around noon. She said her family opened gifts that afternoon, and sometime during that window, Stephen showed up.
They all said Merry Christmas, hugged, or shook hands, and Tina recalled him saying that he couldn't stay long, he had to go to work, and then he left.
Roughly an hour later, Tina says Little Bowman left too, but the timeline gets murkier from there.
According to Tina, on December 26th, the day after Christmas, she was riding her bicycle when she saw Stephen driving around. She flagged him down and asked for a ride to the store to get cigarettes.
She said he was driving the station wagon, the Impala. They loaded her bike in the back, and Stephen took her to the gas station where she bought a drink and a pack of cigarettes.
That's the first and only eyewitness account that we've read placing Stephen behind the wheel of the Impala after December 25th. When asked if she recalled the first time she'd seen Stephen in the station wagon, Tina said on Christmas Day when he stopped by to see them, and she thought he'd owned the station wagon for about a week.
Then comes December 27th, the last day Stephen was seen. Tina said she was at home that morning when Stephen pulled up in the Impala around 7 a.m. He had come to pick up Little Bowman. The two were going to the store.
Now, one thing about that is that you've got to go back and consider that also on the 27th, Stephen had filed that burglary report.
Mm-hmm.
So between, I guess, really 7:20-ish based on that report from the burglary, he was at home. So she could just have her time off. You know, like, he could have came by after the report was filed. But it couldn't have been at 7 a.m. because that's, I think, when the deputy's going to be there. Unless, of course, he found this after what the report actually says. So it says, occurred on or between December 27th, 4 a.m. and 7:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. And when you go down, it says, on the above date and time, I was dispatched to Stephen's address. Upon arrival, victim stated that his bedroom window has been broken. And so we went through that the last time. But if you look at the actual date and time of report, it says December 27th, 7:30 in the morning.
Mm, yeah.
He either reported this after he gets back from, I mean, they literally live, I'd have to look, it's way less than a mile. I mean, you come out of Stephen's driveway and you have to pass their house before you get to anything else. So it's possible that he got there early that morning to pick up Bowman, drop Bowman off. You know, all this happened around 7 a.m. Then he goes home and finds out, hey, my house has been broken into.
True.
She also recalled them arguing before they left. But Stephen drove little Bowman to the store and brought him right back.
That, she said, was the last time she saw him.
According to Tina, little Bowman was gone much of either the 26th or 27th selling marijuana.
In her interview, Tina said days later, she overheard her brother on the phone telling someone that he had killed Stephen.
She gave investigators a detailed and graphic account of what she heard. And when little Bowman realized she had overheard the conversation, she said he told her she would be next if she repeated it.
Birch asked her if she believed little Bowman. Tina said yes. After hearing the conversation, Tina told them she became sick. Stephen was a nice guy who would do anything you asked.
She also described years of violence, animal cruelty, drug use, and other details so disturbing that we won't repeat them here, but they were enough to leave her terrified and trying to protect her younger stepsister.
On January 16th, she disclosed even more information.
Armed with that and their previous interviews, Birch and Batiste obtained a search warrant. On January 17th, deputies searched the Bowman residence. They seized marijuana seeds, money, a paper with Stephen's name on it, photos of marijuana plants, a tarp, a knife, and clothing. And all of it was sent to Alabama Department of Forensic Sciences for testing.
But whatever came back, it wasn't enough. Because to this day, no charges have ever been filed in Stephen's disappearance.
Now, when we do multi-part episodes, we typically go back, okay, this isn't just multi-part episodes. We always listen once we put the episodes out. But especially whenever we are doing the multi-part episodes, we go back and right. We listen when we are preparing for the next episode. Because sometimes, regardless of how things are going on, when you're in conversations, you don't always make the connections to various
right.
things.
Sometimes you just have to kind of read it differently. You see it in a different format or just hear it differently.
Yeah. And so we went back and listened to the first and second part and realized there were a lot of contradictions.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to kind of circle back to those because we think they're important in this whole discussion about the Bowmans. In Little Bowman's interview, when investigators asked him how Stephen learned there was marijuana in the package, his answer was pretty telling.
So I'm going to read this quote. It's going to be paraphrased a little bit, so I'm not going to read the whole quote because you got that from the last episode.
And also, there's all those unintelligibles, and it makes it a little bit harder to follow.
Yeah. So this is just kind of the important bits, I think.
Yeah. It gets the context of the answer without all of the like false starts. And I mean, false starts are important in the analysis in general, but they're
for the content that we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. He said, Steve came over and said something about, do you know that package? You know, did you receive the package? My dad said, yeah. And my dad said, there was a bunch of weed in that package. Stephen was like, what? My dad showed him the little bit that he had. Steve was like upset. So we blew it off. Then the postmaster come and got Steve. At first, me and my dad denied. You know, we told them that we disposed of.
And that's already strange because the postmaster had told investigators something very different. That when she and Stephen went to confront the Bowmans, both Bowmans denied receiving any package at all.
Yet, here's little Bowman saying they admitted they had it. They just told her they disposed of it. That's not a small detail. That's a direct contradiction.
how do you go from we have no idea what you're talking about to, oh no, we did tell her, we just got rid of it. We didn't tell her what was in it. We just got rid of it.
You know, we didn't think it was important to say that.
Yeah. But we also knew that we had told a big enough lie that we needed to be there when she got back to fix that.
To
actually
clarify.
Tell the truth. And really only because Stephen told us we needed to.
And he was pretty insistent.
Mm-hmm. And then comes the tractor. This has bothered me from literally the first time I read it.
I
looked at the file and I could not put my finger on why this tractor thing bothered me so bad until I went back and listened again. And I'm like, okay, I know. Little Bowman said that his dad was outside working on the tractor the day that Stephen stopped by, which was the same day Stephen learned what was in the package. He even claimed that Big Bowman had borrowed a wrench from Stephen and had been going over there, presumably to Stephen's, to return it, but hadn't run into him.
Except, listen to Big Bowman's version. Birch, so the last time you saw Steve was when he left your house, when he asked to borrow a wrench? Big Bowman, that's the last time I seen him. Birch, after the postmaster? Big Bowman, after the postmaster.
After the postmaster. So he is already acknowledging that he saw Stephen after Stephen brought the postmaster over there.
Right.
So now we've got conflicting timelines.
And it was Steve that borrowed the wrench.
Right.
Versus
Big Bowman borrowing one from Steve. Now Big Bowman's saying, oh, Steve borrowed one.
Right. Exactly.
And so Little Bowman's put this wrench and tractor moment before the postmaster. Big Bowman's put it after. They've also swapped who the owner of the wrench is. And Tina never mentions a tractor or a damn wrench.
Exactly.
To her, Stephen stopped by on Christmas Day and said, like, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
So crazy. That's like contradiction after contradiction.
Where's the damn wrench?
Yeah. And whose is it?
Right.
And I think either way, if the wrench actually was near the car and the buckets that we can't figure out why with all the buckets.
Yes.
You know, can you tell if it's Stevens or if it might actually be Big Bowman's? Or is it with Big Bowman and you can tell it's Stevens?
So Birch and I actually talked about this. He said people used to put their social security number on their tools.
I know.
Which is weird.
I'm very curious.
You cannot put your social security number on anything now.
Mm-hmm.
They would literally steal your life.
Yeah. That went on for a long time. I kind of remember people doing that. Even when I was younger,
I don't remember.
It wasn't
this.
The whole thing. It was just like the last four, but still.
Well, that's a little better.
Yeah.
I mean, at least that does leave some numbers to the imagination. Mm-hmm. To me, this is like a failure in communication between the Bowmans to get their story straight. Now it has really stood out to me why this freaking wrench is important in this story because they've both brought it up, but neither have matched the other.
Right. And it seems to be an important part of their story.
Right.
Which would lead you to believe, you know, you mentioned that Tina never mentions it at all, but you would think she would if it was that, you know.
Okay. So it really makes me feel like a tractor and a wrench were involved at some point because both of them bring it up.
Yeah. But like they're trying to make an excuse for the tractor and a wrench somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And for like why they might would have been seeing them. Also, because you have Little Bowman saying, oh, he's been going over there trying to return it. Okay, are you trying to establish like an alibi for why your dad would have been over on the property?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you would have to pass by the Bowmans to get to Stephen's house. That's just kind of how that road went. Like there was no way to get the house without passing theirs.
Yeah. So I feel like we could go on about that, but
I will probably never let the wrench go, honestly.
I know. No, that is, yeah, I'm with you. I really believe it has something to do with it. But then there's also the car. Little Bowman told investigators flat out that he didn't even know Stephen owned a blue station wagon.
Yet Tina saw Stephen in the station wagon three separate times. Once on Christmas Day, yep, when he came by and told them Merry Christmas. The next day, when he drove her to the store, like she was on her bike, saw him driving around in the station wagon. He stopped, put her bike in the back, took her to the store to get her cigarettes and her drink. She rode her bike back. I'm assuming we had some unintelligibles in there. Then the next day, he picked up Little Bowman, according to Tina, at their house around 7 in the morning to go get cigarettes in the station wagon. And she said it looked like they were arguing. And that was the last time she ever saw Stephen. She puts little Bowman in the freaking station wagon.
Right before he goes missing. And Big Bowman, his long-winded answer about Stephen being, quote, frisky, includes him claiming he was told by a deputy about Stephen's blue station wagon back in the woods with the checkbook inside.
Yeah, he doesn't say in that answer that he knows or doesn't know Stephen has a station wagon. He just says somebody told him there was a station wagon back in the woods. But one thing, and oh my gosh, I need to get the audios for this, because he says something about, I didn't know he was back in the woods. And now I really want to hear how this answer actually went, because I'm like, what do you mean you didn't know he was in the woods? You didn't know the deputy was in the woods? Why were you in the woods to begin with? Who's in the woods that you're talking about in this, you know? It's a really weird answer, and it's so long and not well put together that it's confusing even with the unintelligible. I think it's probably going to still be just as confusing without them if you can understand it.
I think the only way you're going to even come close to understanding it is probably to hear it.
Yeah. Yes. There's enough in there that like raises the red flag. Here's the thing, like the deputy who supposedly gave him that information, he denied ever saying it. Birch called him and asked, hey, did you tell him about this car and the checkbook? And the deputy's like, yeah, I talked to him, but no, I never said anything about a checkbook or even told him what kind of car was in the woods to begin with.
I mean, that was kind of standing out to me because, well, we know that there was a problem with the checkbook because of the break-in or whatever that was at Stephen's house. How did Big Bowman know about the checkbook? Was it just small-town gossip, or did he actually know because he was closer to the car and to Stephen's disappearance than he wanted to admit?
And now I want to know from that burglary report, because I don't think it's in there, what vehicles were there that day?
I am very curious myself. I kind of wonder, did they just make a report
station wagon
or did they
there?
Take pictures?
Because if the station wagon was there, or if it wasn't there, and the checkbook's in the driveway, what are the check numbers?
Like,
do
which
they match?
Checks?
Is it the same checkbook that was in the driveway that's found in the station wagon that wasn't there the day of the report? And that's all speculation. We don't know because it's not on the report. I don't think they mentioned anything about the vehicle.
Seriously, why would Big Bowman even bring up a checkbook?
Because speaking of checks, he also slipped in a strange detail that Stephen said he was going to, quote, take care of some kind of check.
Exactly. That's just bizarre. I mean, to me, that's another, okay, there's got to be a reason I need to know about this checkbook.
And checks.
And checks, yeah.
And money in general. Money and wrenches. Mm-hmm. Money and wrenches. Like, that's what is like.
Yeah. Like, if we have an excuse, then they can't question
it. Yeah. And they knew the habits. That wasn't like Stephen to just leave his checkbook lying around. He kept that in his wallet. That was comments both of them made. Both those interviews said, well, that wasn't like Stephen.
And seriously, what check? I mean, was Stephen planning to cash it? Could that have led someone to believe he'd been carrying cash later? Because if that's true, it raises another question then. Why stop at an ATM in Biloxi if you just cashed a check?
So there's a $900 check out of AmSouth on the 27th.
Huh.
Because what I was thinking, actually, now, obviously, that's not the case, was that, okay, is this going to be around the time that he got that loan, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But it's not. There was a $900 check that came out of his AmSouth account on the 27th.
Hmm.
On the 27th, Larry Ferguson sees Stephen driving his Blazer around 8 o'clock on the 27th. That's when he's got the 2-minute call to Julie, then the call to her now deceased mother-in-law, and then a 2-minute call to Singing River, which is the last activity on his phone, right? There's also a letter dated December 27th from AmSouth that is a check card. And it's like, you know, thank you, whatever, here's your new check card. Which initially I was just like, okay, maybe it expired. But then I started looking at the financials that we had. I think that was a new AmSouth account. I don't think he started that until December of 2000. On December 27th, there actually was a check for $900 that cleared the AmSouth bank. So maybe that's the check that he's talking about.
Huh.
There's no images on those AmSouth statements. So you don't know whether that was like written to somebody, whether it was cash, whatever. just that a $900 check came out. And it looks like, based on the bank statement, that's going to be like one of those counter checks because there are no check numbers. Like, I'm looking at this check card and the fact that there are checks that are clearing this account and they don't have numbers. This is a new account. He didn't have checks for it.
Yeah. Interesting.
The first time the AmSouth account actually pops up is on December 21st when he deposits that $2,000.
That's what I'm thinking. That must have been when he opened it.
I think so, too. And I think that's actually around the time that he took out that line of credit or the home equity. Mm-hmm. He got that loan right around then. It was like the $5,000 random dollar loan. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It looks like it was kind of like taking credit to stay ahead on other credit. This one was getting past due, so he'd go take out another line of credit to pay off that one. Does that make sense? Mm. And so when you look at the payments and stuff, on December 21st, AmSouth is going to be the opening deposit for that account.
Right.
And there's no activity out of that account
until the
27th when that $900 check comes out.
Yeah. Everything else is like a check that he would have written before or something, or like an auto withdrawal.
Well, I think it's going to be those counter checks because they don't have numbers.
It's so weird.
Not having the images, you can't tell when they were actually written. Did they just hold them for a while and then they crossed the bank?
Right.
Was there a delay in the actual transaction? And that's why, like, we see these checks that are clearing in January, you know, after the missing person report's filed. There's a deposit into that AmSouth account. I want to say in January. Yeah, it is in January, like beginning of January. There's like a $300 deposit. Well, that was his brother. Bill made that to keep the account from overdrafting. Gotcha. But it's interesting because we now, and since we, you know, tree branched off of that, he's telling them he's got to do something with this check. And we've got this $900 check clearing on the same day, which makes me think he probably wrote a check for cash at the bank. And we already know he had some weird cash movement.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then why the ATM stopped?
Yeah, I don't know.
So when you put all of that together, the contradictions about the package, that freaking wrench, the station wagon, the checkbook, you're left with this unsettling picture.
Two men, father and son, who couldn't keep their story straight. Tina, who consistently placed Stephen in that car with him. And a deputy who denies ever sharing details that the Bowmans claim to have heard.
And then you have the witnesses who also heard the Bowmans saying they saw the checkbook on the front seat. Which leaves us asking, what exactly did the Bowmans know about Stephen's finances, his car, his checkbook, and how did they know it?
The case file also reveals pieces of Stephen's life in the weeks after he vanished. His brother Bill wrote frequently to the investigators, sending updates about packages arriving in the mail, crystal and toy trucks Stephen had ordered, and questions about whether Stephen might have rented a car with cash.
Bill even spoke with Stephen's psychiatrist, who told him Stephen had never expressed suicidal thoughts. The doctor believed Stephen was likely dead, though not because of mental illness, but because of the silence that followed.
And then there was Stephen's calendar. Investigators found it, full of cryptic codes and abbreviations that made no sense to anyone but him. To this day, nobody has been able to decipher it.
2 years later, in 2002, a safety deposit box turned up. It hadn't been opened since 1996. Inside were old foreign currency, a deed, some jewelry, but nothing that solved the mystery of Stephen's whereabouts.
In 2004, a skull was found in Missouri. For a moment, hope spiked, but dental records ruled it out. Something we noted in Stephen's financial records were regular stops at an ATM that appeared to be located at Pascagoula Police Department. We connected with an investigator at Pascagoula PD, who confirmed the address associated with the ATM is the ATM located in their lobby. However, he was unable to find any record of Stephen in their file. Why Stephen was stopping at an ATM located in the police department when he had so many other ATMs he frequently used is still a mystery.
And yet through all these twists, one constant remained. Sheriff Paul Birch.
He said it himself. This is the only unsolved case he still carries. He believes Stephen was murdered. He believes he knows who's responsible. But Without a body, without proof, he can't close it.
Over the years, the case has surfaced in media again and again. Always the same sentiment. Someone knows something.
And then, a new push.
I reached out to Sheriff Pert and asked if he'd let us review the file and help with outreach. And he didn't hesitate when he said yes.
Since then, we've partnered with the Mobile County Commission to put up a billboard for Stephen in Grand Bay, just 5 miles from his home and the Bowman residence.
Mr. Pearson's daughter, who lives in Florida, couldn't be here to speak today, but she sent him an audio recording. And I think Cherie is prepared to play that. And then also today, we have Carrie New here, and she's going to speak real quick about the Alabama cold case advocacy. I know that I spoke about it Thursday, but it's that important that I would like to, for everyone to hear Ms. Pearson's words about her father and her son and his grandson. And then Carrie's going to talk a little bit about her organization if we've got just a moment.
Sure.
Good morning. My name is Julie Pearson, daughter of Stephen H. Pearson, missing from Grand Bay, Alabama since December 27th, 2000. Daddy would give you the coat off of his back if you needed it, and I know of one time he did exactly that for a stranger. When he disappeared, he had one grandson, my son, that he absolutely adored and doted on, just as a grandfather should do. They had their own routines of pawpaw time together, doing fun things like going and getting biscuits and gravy. Daddy would not have gone missing on his own accord, as he had so many reasons to be excited about the future. His grandson, he had gotten a promotion at work, and so many more things. Grand Bay, Alabama once was a small town way back then, where most everyone knew most everyone, and if not, they knew somebody who knew somebody. So someone knows something without any doubt in my mind about Daddy's case. No shadow of a doubt at all. It is imperative to remind them that Daddy is still missed and to please come forward with any information. After 24 years, every detail counts. When Daddy went missing, there was quite the turnout to help search for him. So many knew and liked my dad. It has been a long 24 plus years without answers. It is time for Daddy to come home. Whatever that looks like all these years later, I don't know, but it is past time. Please help spread the word with the billboard about my daddy and help us bring Daddy home. Thank you.
We also worked with Lieutenant Craig Shook from Malia to produce a sketch of what Stephen might look like today. Because while this episode is ending, Stephen's story isn't. Stephen Pearson was a father, a friend, and a neighbor who carried bread and candy to his community on Christmas morning. He wasn't flashy. He was steady, and on one December day, he disappeared. The Bowman stories conflict. Tina's voice, terrified yet brave, cuts through the silence. The cash withdrawals, the cryptic calendar, the staged Impala, all fragments of a puzzle still unsolved.
For Julie, his daughter, there's still a stocking hung every Christmas. For Sheriff Birch, there's still a file on his desk. And for us, there's still a truth waiting to be told.
If you know anything about what happened to Stephen Pearson, please contact Mobile County Sheriff's Office or submit an anonymous tip through our website or use the tip line that we've set up specifically for Stephen's case, 251-501-2653, extension 3. Because Stephen didn't vanish into thin air, somebody knows what happened to him.
And silence only protects the guilty.
For Julie, for Stephen, for every family still waiting, we'll keep searching.
Carrie, if you want to talk a little bit about this, about your organization specifically and about this particular case.
Again, my name's Carrie New. I started Alabama Cold Case Advocacy in 2022. It started out as a social media effort, essentially, because everybody kind of gets their news on social media now, and it was a way to kind of reach the masses quickly. There are roughly 300 missing persons in Alabama, children and adults. The state database does not correlate with the national database. And so we know there are names that are missing from both of them. And there's roughly a 70-person difference between the two databases. Not really sure why that is. Part of that is because there is a voluntary reporting. There's no mandated reporting for missing persons. There is roughly 250,000 unsolved homicides across the United States, and it's a number that's expected to grow about 6,000 a year. It's insane. And as a mom, I thought, what would I want if it were my child? I have a son, and I thought I would want all the resources possibly available. And the public is the largest free resource there is, because then you have eyes everywhere. And so when we started, it was kind of a way to bridge that gap between the families and the law enforcement agencies as far as communication, as far as getting these cases back out in the public's attention. And for families like Stephen Pearson, where it's been over 20 years since they've had any kind of update or anything like that, it is just truly important to them to have people re-engaged and, you know, have their interest sparked again. And so we're pushing for legislation to have cold case policies and procedures along with mandated reporting. And that was part of why we started the social media effort, was to start a petition to circulate, but then also to have this media outreach where we could do things like have billboards, do basically media blitz where we shared the story across it. And working with the sheriff's office here on Stephen's case has been the perfect example of what that looks like. We've worked collaboratively with Sheriff Birch and his investigator, Mitch McCurry, to get Stephen's case kind of updated, get it looked at again. We had a story on Fox 10 not long ago, and then we truly appreciate you guys considering this billboard, because it's going in an area where Stephen was last seen, and anybody that would have information ideally would see it. So getting more eyes on it is more important, because it just increases the chances that somebody will call. Relationships change over the years, and somebody who may not have come forward then might see it and come forward now. And it serves as a way to encourage people. You know, if you know something, it doesn't matter how small you think it is. Maybe it seems completely irrelevant to you in your mind, but to somebody who has the big picture, to a law enforcement agency who's just missing that one piece to their investigation, it can make a huge difference. So this is a huge deal, and I'm super appreciative for the opportunity that you guys are giving us.
Well, thank you. And I'll repeat real quickly what I said on Thursday. This case was initially investigated by Sheriff Birch when he was a homicide investigator. And it was later looked at by many sets of eyes, including mine, as a cold case. And again, it's tough to go behind Sheriff Birch because he's a good investigator. But it's the opinion of Sheriff Birch and myself both that a homicide has been committed. That's our professional opinion as law enforcement officers. And I think this serves two things. Number one, it gives some closure to the Pearson family if we can get to the bottom of this, but also, you have to keep in mind, if there was a homicide committed, that means that the person who committed this homicide is potentially still at large. And if you're capable of committing one homicide, I'm under the impression that you're capable of committing another. So thank you, Carrie, for bringing this to me, and I'm super happy to sponsor this.
Thank you.
With that said, Eddie.
26. Approved sponsorship agreement with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy in the amount of $3,750 from District 3 Commission funds for a billboard in Grand Bay promoting awareness for the Stephen Pearson missing person case.
So moved.
Second.
On September 12, 2008, Stephen's family filed a petition with the Mobile County Probate Court requesting the issuance of a death certificate. While the petition stated that Sheriff Birch, who was sergeant at the time, and others were expected to testify that Stephen was the subject of a homicide and that the pending investigation was now considered a cold case, The petition requested the cause of death be listed as accidental. On May 11, 2009, probate judge Don Davis issued an order granting the petition and officially declared Stephen deceased as of December 27, 2000.
Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Red Circle to your favorite podcast platforms. Content, research, artwork, and production are by Sellers and Stormy of Alabama Cold Case Advocacy. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and research sources can be found in each episode's description. Your support helps us continue producing Unforgotten and further Alabama Cold Case's mission of advocacy and awareness. There are a few ways you can help us light the path. Make a one-time or monthly donation to Unforgotten through Red Circle, sign up for a one-time or recurring donation through the ACCA website, or subscribe to the Unforgotten Patreon channel for early access to ad-free episodes. You will find the links for all three in our episode descriptions. Another cost-free way to be of great help is to follow us on social media, but most importantly, whatever you do, tell everyone you know about these cases. Sharing their stories is one of the most effective ways to help find resolution for Alabama's cold cases. Be the spark. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
That was good. You did good on that one.
Thanks.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.